Lecture 4 of Man's Being, His Destiny, and World Evolution, lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner. In viewing the soul of man, we find its inner element composed of thinking, or forming of mental representations, feeling, and willing. You know that these three soul activities have often been discussed by me. Nevertheless, I should like to say a few words today about this threefold constitution of the human soul, inasmuch as it is in especial connection with the present cycle. Life in the waking state is essentially concerned with our mental activity. Of what we are thinking, we are fully conscious in the waking state. If you ask yourself, are we as conscious of the feelings that we experience in the waking state as we are of the mental representations? The answer would have to be in the negative. In a certain sense, feelings are apprehended but dimly and vaguely by waking consciousness. And if you compare the experiences of your world of feelings with those confronting you in the manifold imagery of the dream world, you will find the same degree of consciousness in the world of feelings that you do in the world of dreams. In the world of feelings, we dream in a different way, yet also in that world it is still only dreaming. We may be easily misled regarding the character of this world of feeling by translating that which is felt into mental representations. We make a mental image of our feelings. In this way, the feelings are raised into waking consciousness. Yet the feelings as such are no more conscious than dreams. What remains still more unconscious, it might be said wholly unconscious, are man's will impulses. Try to visualize what you know of the faculty generally called willing. Suppose that you stretch out your hand in order to grasp something. First, you have a mental image of the fact that you are going to stretch out your hand. This is what you intend to do. But how this intention streams down into your whole organism, how it is imparted to the muscles, the bones, so that your hand be enabled to grasp an object, of all this you know as little as you know in your ordinary consciousness of what happens to your ego during sleep. Only after grasping the object, you become aware, again by means of a mental image, of having carried out a movement. What lies between the mental image forming the intention and the image engendered within you after this intention has been acted upon externally, what happens within your organism between these two stages is hidden by a sleep which takes possession of you even in the waking state. Willing is a matter of sleeping, feeling a matter of dreaming, and only mental activity, thinking, is a matter of real waking. Here we have, even in the waking state, the threefold human soul. The waking soul that forms mental images, the dreaming soul that feels, and the willing soul that sleeps. Hence man can never know out of his ordinary consciousness what goes on in those regions where the will is weaving and living. If, however, we illuminate, by the methods of anthroposophical research, the regions where the will is pulsating, we discover the following. The intention of carrying out a will impulse is primarily a thought, a mental image. At the moment when this intention streams down into the organism, something is produced that might be called a process of inner combustion. Invariably, this combustion is kindled in the organism along the entire path followed by the will impulse. The combustion of metabolic products existing within you brings forth the movement used by the arm in order to carry out a will impulse. Hence, someone who wills an action undergoes in a physical sense a burning up and consuming of his metabolic products. The metabolic products must be renewed for the reason that they are being constantly burned up, consumed by the will impulse. It is different in mental activity. Here a constant depositing of salt-like particles takes place. Earthy, salt-like, ash-like particles are excreted from the organism. Thus, in a physical sense, thinking or mental activity is a depositing of salt. Willing is a combustion. To the spiritual view, human life appears as a continuous depositing of salt from above and a combustion from below. This combustion has the effect of preventing, by the fire within our body, if I may express it in this way, our perceiving. This combustion has the effect of preventing, by the fire within our body, if I may express it in this way, our perceiving, by means of our ordinary consciousness, the real nature of will. This combustion puts us to sleep in regard to our will, or will impulses. And what becomes invisible to our ordinary consciousness while we are asleep? If, by the methods of spiritual research, we illuminate the organic fire, constantly being kindled through the will, we perceive that this fire contains the effects of our moral behavior during previous earth lives. What lives in this fire may be designated as human destiny, human karma. It is actually true that a certain fact may assume an entirely different significance if looked at from a correct spiritual viewpoint instead of an external, sensible, intellectual one. For instance, a man may become acquainted in a certain year of his life with another man. This is generally considered as accidental. And it really seems as if the two persons had been led together by the accidents of life and become acquainted at a chance moment. Things, however, happen otherwise. If we use the methods of spiritual research and look into the whole connection of human life, if we look into everything made invisible by the previously mentioned process of combustion, we then find that an acquaintance made in a man's 35th year has been longed for and striven for by this man during his entire life according to a definite plan. If we follow someone's life from his 35th year back into his early childhood, we may uncover and reveal what paths were pursued in order to arrive at the point where the other man was encountered. All this has been carried out in accordance with a plan harbored in the unconscious. If we look at a human being's destiny in this way, it is remarkable to discover what wiles were occasionally employed by this person in order to arrive at a certain place in a certain year and to encounter a certain person. Anyone having real insight into human life cannot help but say that if someone is undergoing an experience, he himself has sought it with all the force at his command during his entire earth life. And why do we seek a particular experience? Because this seeking has been poured into our soul out of former lives. These former earth lives, however, do not show their effect inside our waking thought consciousness. They show their effect in that state of consciousness constantly lulled to sleep by the process of combustion. Although striving unconsciously, we are nonetheless striving for the attainment of our earthly experiences. Now, if something of this kind is said, various objections may arise in our thoughts. First of all, the following argument might be raised. If all this be true, then our whole life is determined by destiny. We have no freedom. But do we lose our freedom through the fact that our hair is blonde and not black? This too is predestined. We are nevertheless free, even if our hair is blonde instead of black, although we might possibly prefer black hair. We are nevertheless free, even if we cannot pull down the moon as we might have longed to do as children. We are nevertheless free, even though we have sought certain experiences since the beginning of our earth life. For not all of human life is composed of such destined experiences. These experiences are always joined to freely chosen experiences. And these freely chosen experiences, joined to the others, are found by spiritual science in a different place. I have often spoken of the three stages of spiritual knowledge. Imagination, when we first view a world of images. Inspiration, when this world of images is penetrated by spiritual reality and essence. Intuition, when we stand amid spiritual reality and essence. If the human being in the course of his spiritual research attains imagination, and hence sees before him the tableau of his life, something else always becomes visible at the same time. One cannot be attained without the other. We cannot attain imagination, real spiritual knowledge of the life lived by us heretofore on earth, without seeing emerge in a strange, memory-like manner the experiences undergone by us during sleep, between going to sleep and waking. I have told you of what these experiences consist. When attaining imagination, on the one hand, we attain on the other by means of the inner silence enveloping our soul, an especially profound view of what the human being experiences during sleep. I have already described to you many things experienced by us during the sleeping state. What, however, is mainly set before our inner eye in sleep concerns destiny, as it forms itself anew. If we illuminate the sleep that encompasses our will, even in the waking state, we can see at work the karma resulting from previous earth lives. And if we see in their true light the experiences undergone by us between going to sleep and awaking, we recognize how the karma that will be realized in our next earth life is being woven out of the free deeds performed by us in the present earth life. You might believe that those able to fathom the realm of sleep might be perturbed when saying to themselves, "Your own moral conduct during the present earth life is preparing your karma." Yet this fact is no more perturbing than the knowledge that the sun has risen, climbed to its highest position at noon, and sunk in the evening below the horizon, and will repeat the same course on the morrow. The lawfulness arising from the depth of slumber does not perturb us, because through freedom all that has been formed in the sleeping state of the present earth life can in the most manifold ways be brought forth during the next earth life. And when we envisage that which begins to weave itself in sleep, hidden from our ordinary consciousness as new karma, we can clearly see karma at work in the subconscious states of our will, clearly see karma being spun anew. We can also see how the past is being interwoven in the human being with the future. We can see how that which is veiled to the waking human being by sleep in the daytime, that is to say, the inner secrets of his will, is being spun together with that which is veiled to him by sleep at night, namely the inner secrets of his ego and astral body, as they have separated themselves from the physical and etheric bodies and are taking part in weaving the future karma. Consider that the things thought by man in his ordinary waking state are mostly concerned with outer matters. These outer things thought by us remain fixed by means of our soul life's ordinary content in our memory. All this, however, represents only the surface of our soul life. Beyond this thought level lies a soul life of much greater profoundness. Whatever we experience during the waking state is our thinking, we experience in the etheric body, the formative force body. All that happens at a deeper level in the astral body and the ego can be experienced only by consciously penetrating the events passed through by the astral body and the ego when they have separated themselves from the physical and etheric bodies and fallen asleep. Then the future karma is being spun. In the daytime, this future karma is veiled to us by the outward thoughts contained in the etheric body. In the depth of the soul, however, it is being woven together, also during the day, with that which dwells in unconscious sleeping will as the karma emerging from the past. Hence the karma of the human being can be accurately divulged. Here we find several interesting facts. The age of the human being's earliest childhood is especially revealing for the observation of karmic connections. The resolutions of children appear to us as utterly arbitrary, and yet they are not at all arbitrary. It is indeed true that the child's actions imitate what goes on in the child's surroundings. I have indicated in my public lecture how the child, completely at one with his sense organism, inwardly experiences every gesture, every movement made by the people around him. But he experiences every gesture, every movement, in its moral significance. Hence a child who is confronted with a choleric father experiences the immoral element connected with a choleric temperament. And the child experiences through the subtlest movements of the people around him the thoughts that these people harbor. Hence we should never permit ourselves to have impure, immoral thoughts in a child's presence and say such thoughts are permissible because the child knows nothing about them. This is not true. Whenever we think, our nerve fibers are always vibrating in one way or another, and this vibration is perceived by the child, especially during his earliest years. The child is a subtle observer and imitator of his surroundings. The strangest, and it might be said the most interesting fact, in an exalted sense, is the following. The child does not imitate everything, but takes his choice. And this choosing is done in a very complicated manner. Let us assume that the child has before him a hot-headed, choleric father who does many things that are not right. The child, wholly one with his sense organism, must absorb all these things. Since his eye cannot protect itself, it must perceive what takes place in the child's surroundings. What the child absorbs, however, is absorbed only in the waking state. Eventually the child goes to sleep. Children sleep a great deal. And during sleep a child is able to choose. What he wants to absorb is sent out of his soul into his body, his physical organism. What he does not want to absorb is ejected during sleep into the etheric world. Thus the child takes into his bodily organism only those things that have been predestined for him by his destiny, his karma. The working of destiny is seen with especial vividness in a child's very first years. A person with a merely intellectual bent often feels that he is tremendously clever and the child tremendously stupid. After acquiring insight into the world, we discard this opinion and begin to realize how stupid we have become since our childhood. Our present cleverness, as opposed to that of childhood, is a conscious one, yet far, far greater than all the wisdom given to us in later years is the wisdom with which the child, as was previously described, chooses between that which, according to the destiny resulting from former earth lives, he must incorporate into himself, and that which he may eject into the general etheric world. And what is brought by man from former earth lives into his present one becomes especially visible during the first years, when the question of freedom does not matter as yet. At the age when the consciousness of freedom arises, we have already brought into the present earth life most of what had been destined to be garnered from previous earth lives. And if someone has a certain experience at the age of 35, he has blazed a trail toward this experience since his first childhood years. The first steps of life are the most important and essential for all that is determined by destiny. I have tried to point out how wise we were as children, and how fundamentally we become less and less wise as life continues. Our consciousness expands, hence we value conscious rationalism and do not value the child's unconscious wisdom. Only by acquiring the science of initiation are we taught how to value this wisdom. I have called attention to these things in the very first chapter of my booklet, Spiritual Guidance of Man and Humanity. Official philosophy has taken me severely to task on this score. It is important, nevertheless, that we are capable of looking at the first years of childhood in the right way. People, once they have understood these things, will attain a sounder judgment on something that is mentioned today again and again, but not understood in the least, the question of inherited qualities. In present-day literature and science, the tendency is to base everything on qualities that have been inherited from the parents. If we once realize how the child in a karmic sense gathers from previous earth lives whatever his wisdom urges him to select, we shall comprehend the correct relation between that which is determined by destiny and that which represents external inheritance and garb. For this inheritance is nothing but an external garb. That the latter exists will not seem strange to those comprehending in the right way how the human beings connect themselves at a certain point between death and a new birth with the sequence of generations. Turning their glance from the beyond to the earthly realm, they are able to foresee who their parents are going to be. From the beyond, we help to determine the qualities that our parents will have. Hence it is no wonder that we inherit these qualities. Yet, as was previously described, we make our choice concerning the qualities that we inherit. To observe the human being during his first childhood years is a study as interesting as it is exalted. I must use this expression again and again. You will remember that I called your attention to the three things learned by the child in his first years. Walking, which includes so many things that were discussed yesterday, speaking and thinking. These three faculties are attained by the child. Now let us observe correctly how the child takes his first steps. He may put down his little legs and feet firmly or gently, advance courageously or timidly, bend his knee vigorously or with less vigor, use his index finger or his little finger more frequently. Those who have the right insight into what is connected with walking, what is connected with the sense of equilibrium through which the child orientates himself in the three spatial directions, all those will recognize that the child's karma is symbolically expressed in his attempts at walking. We see a certain child, as he learns how to walk, put down his little feet with firmness. This shows us that he has proved himself as brave and courageous in various situations belonging to previous earth lives. This brave and courageous quality coming from previous earth lives is expressed in a sensible image by the firm manner in which the child plants his little feet on the ground. Thus we may observe just in the child's first attempts at walking a miraculous image of human karma. A man's personal karma is especially expressed by the manner in which he learns how to walk. In the second place, we learn how to speak. We imitate what is spoken around us. Every child does this in his own way, yet all human beings who learn how to speak their mother tongue within a lingual province imitate just this one language. Hence we find that the human being's folk destiny is expressed by the way in which the child adapts himself to the imitation of sounds. The child, when learning how to walk, expresses his individual destiny. When learning how to speak, his folk destiny. And when learning how to think, he expresses the destiny of universal mankind living in a certain period all over the globe. Thus a threefold destiny is interwoven in man. It is true that we clothe our thoughts with diverse languages. Yet when penetrating across language to the thoughts, we assume that these can be understood by every person anywhere in the world. A Chinese and a Norwegian language exist. Nonetheless, there is no difference, except an individual one, between Chinese and Norwegian thoughts. For it must be admitted that thoughts as such, with regard to their truth or untruth, are the same everywhere. They are differently colored for the sole reason that human beings express themselves through language and individual traits. The thought content, however, not the form, is alike for all men. By adjusting himself to thought life in his third stage, the child adjusts himself, at a certain point, to all of mankind. Through language he adjusts himself to the folk destiny, through his orientation in three spatial directions, by learning how to walk, how to handle objects, and so forth, he adjusts himself to his personal, individual destiny. In order to understand man's being in the right way, these things must be viewed from all sides. Now I should like to explain to you, by means of another fact, how the whole of human life is constituted. Let us go back to the sleeping state, to those experiences undergone by us between falling asleep and awaking. Here we go back with our ego and astral body into the spiritual world. We go back to the starting point of our life. Yet the ego and astral body are weaving our future destiny. When the ego and astral body return again to the physical body, then destiny has been woven anew, night by night. Man's ordinary consciousness, however, does not yet know anything of this destiny. He enters again into his physical and etheric bodies. In the etheric body, he had left behind his thoughts. We only assume that we do not think while lying in bed. We think unceasingly, but unbeknown to ourselves, because our ego and astral body dwell outside our thoughts. Thinking is an activity of the etheric body. You can easily observe this fact even in everyday life. For instance, you have heard, for the first time, a symphony that excited you greatly. If you are inclined to wake up during the night, you will do so again and again, always finding yourself amid this symphony's sounds, which continue to vibrate within your etheric body. These vibrations do not cease. It is not necessary that your ego be present while the symphony reverberates within you. If your ego were present, you would be aware only of the etheric bodies of vibrations. It is the same with other thoughts. You are thinking all night long while lying in bed, since your ego is away. However, you do not know that you think. I can even disclose to you that waking life often spoils our thinking. Generally, our thoughts are much keener when our ego is away at night. This is true whether you believe it or not. Most people's judgment on life is much sounder at night than in the daytime. If the etheric body, which is in harmony with the laws of the universe, thinks by itself, and man does not ruin these thoughts, then man's thinking, no longer muddled up by the ego as happens so often in the daytime, becomes much sounder. While our ego and astral body are outside our physical and etheric bodies, we are engaged in weaving our future karma. What, as ego and astral body lives and weaves outside us, between falling asleep and awaking, must pass through the portal of death. It must enter and pass through the supersensible world. It is true that the astral element is subsequently merged with the ego, which thus undergoes a change of substance and must continue its way alone. Yet all that which has been weaving in the sleeping state, outside the physical and etheric bodies, must pass through the portal of death, and must, between death and a new birth, pursue its path across the stages described by me during the recent days. My description has shown you how the ego passes through a stage where it works in unison with the beings of the higher hierarchies, in order to prepare the spiritual germ of a future physical body. This work necessitates the experiencing of profound wisdom between death and a new birth, an experience that can be undergone only if sharing a spiritual activity with beings of the higher hierarchies. Many other things must be merged with the karma, as it is woven between falling asleep and awaking, in order to unite all the elements into a future physical body. For you must consider what kind of path has to be pursued. All that is being woven as karma dwells in the ego and astral body. It must descend into those regions possessed by us in the next earth life as the unconscious will regions. All these elements must be thoroughly blended with our entire bodily organism. During the ordinary sleeping state, the ego and astral body have, as yet, but little of what they must attain during their transition between death and a new birth. From the sleeping state, the ego and astral body must return to the physical body, and when they wake up, they do not quite understand how to deal with this physical body. For having received this body as the result of a previous earth life, they do not know how to immerse themselves into it in the right way. Because the astral body and ego can form the physical and etheric bodies only in the next earth life, working on them in childhood, during the first and second seven-year period, and because the ego and astral body will only then encompass all that can work in the right way on the physical body, therefore now, when the ego, on falling asleep, has just absorbed the human being's moral conduct and karma, Because the astral body and ego can form the physical and etheric bodies only in the next earth life, working on them in childhood during the first and second seven-year period, and because the ego and astral body will only then encompass all that can work in the right way on the physical body, therefore now, when the ego, on falling asleep, has just absorbed the human being's moral conduct, and karma has just begun to weave itself, this ego, on awaking, does not rightly understand all the things contained in the physical body. The ego, when again immersing itself in the physical body, is utterly unconscious. Yet as it passes through the region of mental activity, confused dream images arise. What do these signify? Why do they correspond in many cases so little to life? Because the ego and astral body try to immerse themselves in the physical and etheric bodies, but find it difficult to do so. This discrepancy between that which the ego cannot do, but which it should do according to the wise principles of the physical and etheric bodies, this discrepancy is expressed by the confused images dreamed by us just before awaking. These dreams show us pictorially how the ego tries to bring what it has not yet attained into a certain harmony with the physical and etheric body. And only when the ego, suppressing consciousness in regard to the will, immerses itself in subconscious regions, and hence no longer relies upon its own wisdom, can it enter again into the physical body without producing confused mental images. If the ego, on awaking, plunged into the physical body when fully conscious, or half-conscious as in dreams, then the most terrifying dreams would arise from man's entire physical body. Only the circumstance that we plunge at the right moment into the unconscious will subdues the fleeting dream images and lets us sink down as proper egos and proper astral bodies into the regions of the unconscious will. It is quite clear to anyone looking at these things without prejudice that every dream can show us the disharmony existing in the present life between what the ego and astral body have acquired in this present life and the fully developed physical and etheric bodies. First, that which has been woven as moral element must unite itself during the transition between death and a new birth with the spiritual germ of the physical body. Then, whatever has been woven in the present life between falling asleep and awaking becomes so powerful that it is really able to sink down during the next childhood life, during this dreamy, half-asleep childhood life, into the physical and etheric bodies, using them as tools for earth life. We carry within us the result of preceding earth lives. Only all that we carry below in our will organism as forces of the preceding earth life is concealed by an inner fire which consumes our physical substance and products. Yet these forces, although consumed by fire, are nonetheless active. We pursue our path across the world by means of our karma. There exists an especial path for every single experience. By choosing from childhood on what we want to imitate from the surrounding world, and by doing so, initiating an event that may not occur until our 50th year, and at the same time, by exerting our will for the purpose of bringing about this experience, we undergo within ourselves a combustion of that which is bodily substance. And because the fire renders us unconscious with regard to our life path, our inner perception transposes what is really a continuous course of destiny into something appearing to us like momentary desires, instincts, urges, varieties of temperament, and so forth. Below courses the life path determined by destiny. The fires are always flaming forth anew. We, however, can only see the fire's surface, and on this surface, out of the seething flames, as it were, there comes to life what dwells in our souls as passions, desires, instincts. Here is only the outer semblance, the outer revelation of that which weaves in the depths as human destiny. What men observe are the single passions, the single instincts, the single desires, momentary likes and dislikes, deeds carried out or not carried out because of momentary sympathy or antipathy. In making such observations, however, we behave like someone who has a sentence before him and says, "Here I see GODRULESTHEWORLD. All he can do is to spell the single letters. Then another person comes and says, "The letters spelled by you mean God rules the world." Just as spelling differs from reading, so does ordinary science differ from spiritual science. Ordinary psychology is able to spell. By looking at a human life, it finds certain instincts and urges in the child. The scientist, who only knows how to spell, registers these things, and thus it continues during the human being's entire existence on earth. Those understanding spiritual science are able to read. Looking beyond the fire's surface, they see what is below, man's destiny-determined life path. Between ordinary psychology, such as it is still practiced today, and genuine knowledge of human soul life, there is a difference akin to that between spelling and reading. We could make ourselves understood with less difficulty if we could only tell the others that they are wrong, but if someone spells G-O-D-R-U-L-E-S, it is impossible to tell him what you say is wrong, for it is perfectly correct. Only the other, lacking the knowledge that the letters can be combined and read, will say to us, "You are a crazy fellow. All that I can see is G-O-D," and so forth. "It would be utterly foolish to combine the letters," unquote. He cannot understand that we are not only able to spell, but also to read. This fact makes our position very difficult. The anthroposophist could easily reach an understanding with the others. He does not have to refute them. Neither is he entangled into polemics against external science. If this science, however, begins to call him a crazy fellow, then naturally he is forced to state that this is wide of the mark and point out his willingness to consider as valid what the others want to consider as valid. Only he would have to exclude the following principle. Whatever this or that person does not see is non-existent. For this principle is no criterion of truth, and those persons who hold to it should first ascertain whether others can see what they themselves cannot see. In view of these things, those standing on anthroposophical ground must be able to fathom this difficult relationship between anthroposophy and other world views. At most, we could come to the conclusion that the one tolerating nothing but G-O-D-R-U-L-E-S should be considered as semi-illiterate. Likewise, we might possibly say to the one who could not wean himself of the habit to spell out the single instincts, urges, passions, temperaments, and so forth, quote, "You are a semi-Philistine, a semi-blockhead. The trouble with you is that you cannot soar," unquote. We could not tell him, however, that he was wrong. The issue between anthroposophy and other world views is of such nature that no understanding can be reached until those who know only how to spell will have a mind to learn how to read. Otherwise, no mutual comprehension is possible, and for this reason, all the customary debates lead to no result whatsoever. This fact is noticed by very few opponents of anthroposophy. In my opinion, it is essential that these things should be known to you. The opponents of anthroposophy increase with every month, yet they are unable to find a foothold. For since anthroposophy always agrees with them, but they refuse to agree with anthroposophy, they cannot attack very well what the anthroposophist says. And for this reason they attack his personality, defame it, tell lies about it. Unfortunately, polemics tend more and more toward such a form. This must be envisaged by those standing on anthroposophical ground. You must consider that a very odd assortment of antagonistic books exists nowadays. Many of their authors who have read anthroposophical literature may have found out that I myself, in certain passages of my own books, mention all the objections that could be raised. I engage in polemics against myself in order to show how that which I affirm could be blotted out. Hence all possible objections against anthroposophy can be found in my books. Consequently, many of my opponents busy themselves with copying the arguments which I myself, in my own books, have cited against anthroposophy. They then distribute these writings to others in order to attack anthroposophy. Thus you can find hostile writings plagiarizing my own books and simply copying my words when I say this or that objection could be raised. The fact that the anthroposophist himself has to point out all the arguments that can be advanced against him makes his opponent's task rather easy. I mention these things not for the purpose of harrowing my opponents, but in order to characterize how one must progress if one desires to read life experiences with regard to the will impulses, instead of merely spelling them out. Spelling only shows us what momentarily wells up in the form of urges of animal life expressed by desires, passions, and wishes. Those able to combine these letters and read them will penetrate every individual human destiny. Let me read that again. Those able to combine these letters and read them will penetrate every individual destiny. This human destiny is working at the source of life. And by means of this destiny, the human being joins himself to the ever-continuing course of mankind's whole evolution. And only by comprehending in this way a single human being's entire life are we able to comprehend human history. During the following days we shall contemplate mankind's history, contemplate it as the life of mankind in its destiny before and after the mystery of Golgotha, and we shall also see how the mystery of Golgotha has influenced mankind's development on earth. First, however, I had to erect a foundation and show what is at work within the human being. Only thus can it be recognized in the right way how the gods and the mystery of Golgotha are at work within the individual man, within his entire destiny. The end of Lecture 4.